Welcome to the Charleston School of Law podcast. I'm your host, John Struble. Subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. We are joined today by Charleston Law alum Tony Romeo, graduated in 2016. If the name sounds familiar, well, it should. His company, Deep Sea Vision, has been all over the news in the recent 6 weeks or so as they continue their journey to locate Amelia Earhart's lost plane. Tony, I got to ask you right up front, when I was doing some Google research on this, NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, Wall Street Journal, CNN, digital media around the world are picking up this story. Did you anticipate that level of attention?
We did not. It was caught us off guard. And, you know, when we broke the story of the Wall Street Journal, they asked us, we expected or we thought the Amelia story still had the same star power that it did, you know, a few decades ago. And the attention that this has gotten from all over the world, not just the United States, has been amazing. They just called us a few weeks ago. The Wall Street Journal calls and said this was the most read article of the year so far. So that was, it was nice to hear him say that. But, we knew Amelia was just such a popular, such a fun story. I mean, she was such a great person. The mystery is just, it's captivated people. And in every generation, from little kids to you know, folks that remember her as a kid. So it's been really nice to see that Amelia is still as popular as she was back in 1937.
Yeah. How familiar were you with Amelia Earhart's story before this whole thing started evolving into you doing a search?
My dad was a pilot for Pan Am for nearly 45 years. And okay. So it was a story we talked about a lot growing up. And I was, you know, a private pilot myself, went to the Air Force Academy, was an Air Force intel guy. So, I mean, it was, you know, for me, aviation was part of our family's DNA. And I love the story. I love the kind of the riddle of it, but as this story has rolled out, folks have called and told us things about her that I had no idea. We spoke to a lady, she's 103 years old, probably the last person that remembers Amelia. We had a Zoom call with her, believe it or not. And she actually flew with Amelia and she told us a few things about Amelia that, you know, nobody else you can't read about anywhere. It was incredible. She was in high school and she won some competition to go flying with Amelia, her and one other, a boy in the class, and they were interested in flying, and Amelia came to her town and picked them up in a plane and went flying with them. She said it was like and this is 1937, right?
Right.
And this isn't like today's aviation, right? General aviation. You just go out and, I mean, this is back when flying was brand new and probably still a little bit dangerous.
I want to know how a guy who graduates from law school to this journey.
For me, it's always been, life's been about chapters. Did the Air Force thing, did the startup, went to law school. Really the point for me, law school was not about really ever going to work at a firm. You know, a lot of guys in our class, that was, you know, that was the goal, and they really want to do that. For me, it was always about using it as a tool for other projects. So for me, it was brokering my own deals, writing my own leases, dealing with any title issues, negotiations with tenants, things. I could handle any kind of legal matter that sort of came my way. And it was very helpful. Yeah. And then made a decision I wanted to get out of real estate. And so this was getting into something a little bit more adventurous was sort of the plan. Law and my license, I've kept it active, has continued to be helpful in every step along the way.
It's one of those tools you can have in your toolbox you can use in pretty much any situation that can.
Right.
Was there a specific mission? Did you do some research on Amelia and started to pull that together and then go out and search? Or were you doing like a general search, a sweep kind of an area, and you spotted this?
As Amelia is coming into Howland Island, tiny little speck in the Pacific, she makes six radio calls. And each one of those radio calls has been written down to meet her at Howland Island. Hears her on the radio, he writes down the message that she relays. Each one of those six messages contains a clue, not a lot of information, but contains a little bit of a clue as to what she's thinking, where she's going, what her plans are. And so using those bits of information, we sort of mapped out an area around Howland Island that we thought was possible based on maybe some mistakes or some assumptions that she made that weren't accurate. One of those being the wind. She says that she's at 1,000 feet, for example. We know that she knew what the wind speeds were at altitude at 8,000 feet, but we know she didn't know what the wind speeds were when she descended, when she was coming down to land and looked for the island at 1,000 feet. So knowing that kind of gave us an idea, okay, she probably overflew the island. And then we overlaid on top of that areas that we knew had already been searched. And we came up with an area based on probabilities. We divided up into sectors, assigned it each sector a probability. probability, and then that we knew some areas were more difficult than others. And so we had a probability, and you combine that with a difficulty score, and you came up with an overall kind of a search plan. I approached this very mathematically, very statistically. Time every minute out there costs a fortune, right? Yeah. So you want to make sure every single moment that thing is at the bottom of the ocean is looking in an area. You're increasing your chances of being successful.
I read in one of the stories that dateline theory about her disappearance 87 years ago. Number one, is that accurate? Number two, what is the dateline theory if it is?
Well, excellent questions. Is it true? I'll take that first. Let's just say we've discovered something that's potentially very valuable. So anything that you've read in the news or seen, even what I've disclosed, may or may not be true. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
You know, folks, they say, well, aren't you worried about somebody else going out there? I said, good luck. If you think I've left enough breadcrumbs to figure out where it's at, good luck.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the keys, isn't it, Tony? Yeah. Like, I mean, the coordinates and stuff, you want to keep those close to your hip, don't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's so Sam Hines, he's a professor sometimes at CSOL. He's worked closely with us, Deep Sea Vision, on this project and has given us some really good counsel. There's a lot of issues, legal issues around, maybe we can talk about some of those that are very interesting. As part of this, yeah, we have to kind of keep it secret and overall, you know, throw people off the trail a little bit too. The dateline theory is pretty straightforward. So it was, she took off on July 2nd. As she's flying, midnight happens, just continue to fly along. So she's on July 3rd. Well, a few hours later, she now crossed over the dateline. So that would have put her back in July 2nd. Fred Noonan, who was in the, so there's two of them in the plane, Fred Noonan, her navigator, if he had forgotten to flip the page back on his almanac for his celestial sightings with the stars and the sun, put them off by 60 miles or so to the west. It's an error that Liz Smith, she posted a paper online about 15 years ago. We really liked it, and we like her math. There's a few things that we kind of disagree with. I believe Fred Noonan was a really, really good pilot. I think it would have been unusual for him to make such a, let's call it, easy mistake. Mm-hmm. But a mistake was made here, right? I mean, whatever it was, somebody goofed up, something was messed up. Was it the dateline? Did he forget to use the right date? If it was, it would have thrown him off by a little bit.
You come up with the mathematical calculation of an area you think is generally a good place to search, and you're able to check off some boxes, what's already been searched, and so on and so forth. Talk to me about when you were planning the journey and how many people were involved, and when did you realize, okay, we're going to go out there and we're going to search this area?
Yeah, it kind of came together it came together quickly in my mind. In actual practice, it took about a year.
Wow.
And in the Wall Street Journal about magnet fishing, I took my son out. And by the way, my wife is also a CSOL grad, Melissa Moss, and we met in law school. We have two kids, Stuart and Ellie, and our son. And I got into this thing called magnet fishing. It was basically a big magnet tied to the end of a rope, and you just go and, you know, we drag it along and out of Breaches Inlet or next to docks or piers or whatever, where you catch is not the right word, but you stick to, you know, all kinds of things, knives, scissors, fishing gear. That got me thinking about all kinds of, you know, other exploration and other things that we could find in the ocean using either magnets or, you know, some other kind of device. And that got me back into reading about Amelia Earhart. At the same time, I was getting out of real estate. Couldn't make any good buying decisions with high interest rates and market conditions kind of getting a little weird. Talked to my wife and I said, what do you think of making a run at, flew out to Norway where we bought the deep water sonar system. And there's only a handful of these in the entire world. And then we spent the next 6 months just trying to get it out of Norway because they wouldn't release it to us. And we talked for an hour about that. We had to get the DOD and other folks involved, the U.S. ambassador out in Norway involved. And finally they said, okay, we believe you. You're not trying to buy this for the Chinese or something. And so they released it to us under a bunch of conditions. While I was out there, I ended up having a drink at a bar with the guy that builds these sonar systems, like the number one sonar guy in the world. It's just like something out of a movie, right? And, you know, at the time I hadn't disclosed what we were going to do with the equipment. And he's asking, like, what are you guys, you know, maybe I had a couple too many. I said, you know, we're going out to look for Amelia Earhart. He literally lost in Papua New Guinea, Lay New Guinea, where she took off from. My uncle died out there. I visited. It's such a, like, story is such an important one to me, such a special one to me. And I said, well, why don't you come out and be our director of operations and run this expedition and help run the equipment. And there's a guy that worked for Kongsberg, the company, for 20 years building these sonar systems. 3 days later, he quits his job at Kongsberg. And then I hired him. And it was the turned into an incredible, like, incredible team between us. He's he runs the operations, the equipment. And so from there, we handpicked a couple other guys that we really trusted, a couple guys that never even did no maritime experience at all, just really just solid guys. And we ended up, my brother ended up coming along too. He was a very important part of the story. And then, so we're making a documentary, right? Random guys that have no sea experience or, you know, specialized knowledge in the industry go out and solve, you know, aviation's most enduring mystery. That's sort of the idea. And that was it. But I mean, that process took, like I said, about a year, a little bit over a year. We launched from Tarawa near a country called Kiribati. It looks like Kiribati on the map, but T-I is pronounced with an S in their country. So Kiribati, Tarawa, Kiribati, and about 3 days away, sail to Howland Island. And then we stayed on site for about 100 days and then came back.
And you get out there, and the typical dive, I've seen this written, is about 36 hours. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. The system could go from here out. If we run this thing as fast as possible, everything was a numbers game for us. If we can run it faster, collect more data, but we have to swap the batteries out more often, right? But you got to bring it back to the surface and you lose some time going up and down. So everything was very mathematically driven. How quickly can we swap the batteries out? How much territory can we see? Do we lose resolution if this thing is going too fast? We knew how big our plane was. We expected it to be intact. So that drove some of our filtering decisions on kind of the resolution that we were looking for. I'm very proud of the guys. Like, we had no down days for weather, no down days for people, no down days for the boat or the equipment, which meant that we were constantly working, constantly these 36-hour cycles with no mishaps or anything. Super, super proud of everybody for that.
What is that psychologically? Can you see certain guys kind of like getting exhausted?
For sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No question about it. By day 100, we were there was definitely guys on each other's nerves. No question about it. And one of the guys I brought was my Indian programmer. I worked with him for almost 20 years. One of the most loyal guys, just very, very smart. But he had this way of eating that was, you know, eat with their hands in India, it's just their culture. And they smack their lips and they're just trying, you know, it's just very loud when they eat. That's just their way of showing this food is good and they like what they're eating. And I tell you, on day 100, people aren't as polite. And it was, but little things start annoying people, and got to figure out a way to deal with it.
Yeah, you're just, the nerves are a little frayed and you're tired and all that stuff. At what point in the dive, Tony, did you spot something of interest? Well, is that happening?
So it's not real time. So it's, while it's at the bottom of the seafloor, it's collecting and storing on a hard drive inside of the AUV, which stands for Autonomous Underwater Vehicle. And then it comes back up to the surface. We pull it back on the boat. We plug in an Ethernet cable into it, and we suck all the data out of it. And then we can review all the information. And by this point, the guys in the container have swapped the batteries, and they've pushed it out. So the thing is already on its next mission. By the time we're reviewing, it takes 4 or 5 hours to really thoroughly review the mission from the last time, but we don't want to waste any time. So if we were to discover something of interest, we could send it a message, not a lot of information because it's so deep, but you could send like a pulse of just a few bits of data and say, hey, Nation, take some better pictures of it. So when we found the image that we released, it was at the end of the expedition. We were actually heading to another job. We got hired to look for another plane in the Pacific. So the data was corrupted. Craig comes down. He says, hey, guys, you need to come up and take a look at this data that I was looking through from earlier in the expedition. I thought something was broken or something was wrong. We all ran upstairs, and sure enough, you know, he plays the kind of, it's like credits in a movie. It's a sonar waterfall. You know, there it was, it clear as day, a plane-like image. So we ended up kind of reviewing it for a little bit. We turned off our satellite communications so nobody could try to sneak a picture off or call back home and say that we'd found something. And, you know, we made a decision that we would release the image. The big thing we were confronting was a broken camera. Our color camera on the AUV had broken very early on. So we couldn't go back and take actual pictures. We had to get to shore, have a new one shipped to us. In fact, it's March now. We just got the camera replaced, just swapped out. It's like a $200,000 part. But anyways, so we made a decision. We're going to release it. Just be very good about hiding our tracks and where we found it.
That's just an amazing story. Do you recall emotionally what that felt like when you see that has the outline of that plane?
You mentioned earlier about the, you know, guys getting on each other's nerves. I mean, here was a moment where we were all very frustrated, a bit disappointed, maybe some blaming, and, you know, like, hey, we should have searched more up in this area, or we should have looked over there, right? And suddenly here it is, and, you know, you've got a group of guys that just felt like they won the state, you know, football championship, you know, give each other a hug. But it was a somber moment too. I know it was like, you know, couple of people died there, or we, you know, we believe they died there. But yeah, no, I remember sitting down thinking this is it. Like, she's not a ghost. She actually, all these theories and everything is like, maybe she was a spy for the Japanese. You start kind of believing some of these ideas, but you know, deep down, we knew she was always around the island someplace. We just had to figure out where it was.
For people who don't know Amelia Earhart's story, and you've talked to so many people, what type of reading would be great if they're listening to this podcast and be like, I want to learn more about her and what her mission was?
She was a great author, by the way. Probably a couple of the best books that you've never heard of that are worth reading. She wrote a book called For the Fun of It, The Best Adventure. Her stories of starting as a nurse in World War I and being invited to fly across the Atlantic, you know, how she got her start. She wrote a book that posthumously called The Final Flight, which was her journey around the world ending in Ley. And she was sending back diary journals of every step along the way, called Mystery Solved by Elgin Long. And his excellent book is probably the best research book out there about her disappearance. And he spent the better part of 3 decades gathering tons of information about her final flight and her disappearance. And like I said, it's called Mystery Solved. And that was a guidebook for her. So when we went on, you know, found her perhaps, but it wasn't, we built on the body of a community of knowledge that a lot of folks have worked towards. Other folks have searched areas that we were able to eliminate. All of that has helped in this discovery. So I can't take all the credit. My brother was very, you know, he had some terrific ideas on what could have happened. Team of guys that were very technically very, Craig Wallace, the guy I mentioned earlier, very, just some of the best sonar expertise in the world. A wife that was very supportive back home. I was gone for 3 months, which was very difficult, missing family for that long. So, I mean, this is all a huge effort. My brother, 5 years, you know, or a couple years ago when we started this, he said, you know, this one's not going to be sitting out there that much longer with the technology and the, you know, the new resources and new sonars are coming out. This one's going to be found soon. And that, for us, that was kind of an impetus. And like, yeah, let's go do this. Let's be the ones to go do this. But we're building on what a lot of other folks have done before us.
You gave the sonar a nickname. What is it?
Miss Millie. That's right. Miss Willie Pollywog. Millie was, so Amelia's nickname growing up was Millie Pollywog. Yeah, Pollywog's a person that has never crossed the equator on a ship. So once you do that, you become like a shellback. Sort of they do this really kind of fancy ceremony, I guess, if you will, and they bring you out on deck and can't spoil all the surprise. But we did the little ceremony when we were on the, when we crossed the, so we actually crossed a point, very interesting point on the globe, which was the equator and the international dateline. So the two hemispheres, obviously, see with the equator, and then yesterday and today, or yesterday and tomorrow, however you will. So you cross over that point, which is what Amelia crossed when she was during her flight, and that may have messed her up, but that's a very interesting point, which is also another ceremony for folks that are in the maritime industry that only a few people have ever done because it's such a remote part of the world.
Were you surprised when you saw on the sonar how it was very evident that it was a plane? I mean, tacked, an aircraft of some sort.
We assessed different possibilities that it could have broken up on impact, but there's been 7 or 8 other planes exactly like hers that had crash landed in the water, believe it or not. And we found through our research that none of them, all of them remained intact during impact. She was a good pilot. She would have glided it in as smoothly as possible. One thing we noticed while we were out there was that right on the equator, there's not a lot of wind, right? It's called the doldrum. So you end up with a very smooth ocean. So she could have landed there probably very similarly to landing on a lake, you know, where you have a, you know, calm conditions. I think she landed and those big scoops of the front engines flipped the plane over and it landed upside down. I don't think it tore the wings off. I don't think we also came to the conclusion if this was a debris field, we were looking at a much different kind of search operation. We'd be looking for small parts, and we all kind of acknowledged that we wouldn't find the plane if that was the case.
How were you able to stay in touch with your family?
Starlink just now gotten going in the Pacific, and we had, I mean, as good internet in the Pacific as we, you know, as we do at home. And joke about it. I was able to FaceTime almost every day. I got to the point where, you know, the kids didn't want to talk to me anymore. I was like, kind of miss the days of satellite, you know, the SATCOM telephones where you only get a couple minutes, right? Because then they have to talk to you and they are interested. But what Starlink's done to the world is just absolutely incredible. They have this, I got to put in a plug for them, and not because of any other reason, but they, you know, when we were on some of these islands, there, you know, pollution and trash is a big problem because they don't have a place to put it. And Starlink, and clean up the beaches and kind of get them to be a little bit more responsible, Starlink's offered free service to a lot of these small Pacific islands in exchange for, you know, internet. And they come back out and they check the islands periodically once a month. And if they're not and the beaches are dirty, they pull the, they pull their internet connections for whatever we paid a few hundred bucks a month. I mean, it was incredible to have that kind of communication connection to the outside world.
It's been about 6 weeks since the story first broke, at least in the media. What has been kind of the progression since the story broke in the news?
Well, there's nothing new on the planning of the equipment is booked through the end of the year. So the first opportunity for us to go back will be early 2025. We have a break of about 90 days this year. You know, we're going to be in Australia. We're going to be in Perth. So the opportunity to maybe take a shot at finding MH370 has come up. The Malaysian government just in the last couple of days has requested a proposal from us to go do a search for that aircraft. The thing that I think is inside of the maritime industry that's gotten a lot of attention aside from the discovery was how we used the Huygen, the equipment. We modified it in partnership with Kongsberg to be able to search basically a mile wide swath instead of the, you know, typical quarter mile, 400 meters.
Okay.
That is very interesting to folks, I think, shipwreck hunters and folks out there that like the Malaysian government that are looking for things. That's what we're working on right now. They've asked for a proposal. We're considering it and maybe put something forward that, you know, would get us to a place where everybody can agree on how we go. But it's a touchy one. There's a lot going on with the MH370. But I think everyone's interests are aligned. I think the Malaysian government wants to find the plane. And I think there's certainly a public outcry 10 years on. Why has this thing not been found yet? So I think we brought our equipment and some of the techniques we used. So to your earlier question, was the plane being intact? The Malaysian plane will likely not be intact. In fact, we're sure it's not because they found pieces from the interior of the aircraft on a beach in Africa. So yeah, it did break up. That one's fascinating. I mean, unfortunately, one jerk looks like took over the plane and then crashed it, suicide murder. If it turns out to be something else, perhaps mechanical or some kind of malfunction, that would be unfortunate, but we could help, you know, resolve that one, hopefully.
What are the legal challenges that have come up for you, or has there been any?
Yeah, how much time do we got?
The 12-part series.
12-part series, here we go. Yeah, it's such a good question, and it's such a, I mean, there's so many interesting angles to this whole thing. Private plane crashed on a island that was not yet U.S. territory in a possibly international waters, but still covered by an exclusive economic zone. The good part is it's not insured. It didn't insure the plane. So you've got constitutional issues with the one I just mentioned. You've got maritime issues. You've got law of the seas, which is, you know, finders keepers, or is this, and then you've got abandonment issues. Was the plane abandoned by the family? And then you've got some contract issues. You've got someone, an owner out there, or I should say owner of an explorer that claims to have bought the rights from the Earhart family and did so. You know, there's some contract issues around that that need to be sorted out. Then you've got, you know, the Earhart family, who's of course very interested in this. We want everyone to kind of get involved and be a part of this. The last thing I want to see is this turn into a legal, everyone fighting over this. Like, we want this thing in the Smithsonian. Everyone agrees to that. There needs to be some discussions around, you know, what happens before it gets there, how it's, you know, how it's raised and how it's cared for. And I want to see all that done properly. And I think everybody does too. So I don't think anybody is against that. Really, we want it owned by American company or Americans for sure. So that's important to everyone. But yeah, this, you know, this is just kind of like anything is going to have to be sorted through. It's a piece of U.S. history, right? Probably one of the biggest treasures, I think, out there. That I say treasures not in a monetary way, but like a treasure of human and American history.
And so many tentacles to it. So the final question, the documentary you're working on, is there a tentative release date?
We are working on it right now. So I expect it to be, we were hoping to have it done by the anniversary of her disappearance, would be July, around July 4th. Okay. But there's just no way that's going to happen. So yeah, I'd expect it to be done in this year. And then, you know, actually the hardest part of this whole thing is getting a boat out there, the right size boat. You think that there's boats everywhere in the world, but you have to have the right size deck. It's got to be in the right port. I mean, and you're talking about an area that's miles and miles away from anything, days away from anything. So I would expect the logistics to all come together early 2025. Stay tuned. Follow us on Instagram, Deep Sea Vision. I'd say that's the best place for announcements, and we'll be posting content.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I know you've probably regurgitated many of these pieces of this story so many times. Yeah.
The legal angle of it is interesting, and I'm happy to come back and talk more about that as this thing progresses, because there's a lot more chapters to be written on that piece of it.
In the meantime, we'll just stay posted on your social media updates. Thank you for taking the time. Thanks so much for coming on the Charleston School of Law podcast.
No problem. Thank you, John. Appreciate it.